Chapter 26. The next day we took the consul's ship out toward the sun. I had awakened, expecting to be feeling some sort of enlightenment, overnight satori from the communion wine, a deeper understanding of the universe at the very least, omniscience and omnipotence at best. Instead, I awoke with a full bladder, a slight headache, but pleasant memories of the night before. Aniya was awake before me, and by the time I came out of the toilet cubby, she had coffee hot in the brewing bulb, fruit in its serving globe, and fresh, warm rolls ready. "Don't expect this service every morning," she said with a smile.
"Okay, kiddo. Tomorrow I'll make breakfast."
"Omelette?" she said, handing me a coffee bulb. I broke the seal, inhaled the aroma, and squeezed out a drop, taking care not to burn my lips or to let the globule of hot coffee get away.
"Sure," I said, "anything you like."
"Good luck in finding the eggs," she said, finishing her roll in two bites. "This star tree is neat, but short on chickens."
"Pity," I said, looking through the transparent pod wall.
"And so many places to roost."
I changed tones to serious.
"Kiddo, about the wine. I mean, it's been about 8 standard hours, and—"
"You don't feel any different," said Aniya.
"Hmm. I guess you're one of those rare individuals on which the magic doesn't work."
"Really?" My voice must have sounded alarmed, or relieved, or both, because Aniya shook her head.
"Uh-uh, just kidding. About 24 standard hours. You'll feel something, I guarantee it."
"What if we're, busy when the time comes?" I said, wiggling my eyebrows for emphasis. The motion made me float free a bit from the stick-tight table.
Aniya sighed. "Down, boy, before I staple those eyebrows in place."
I said, grinning at her over the coffee bulb. "I love it when you talk dirty."
"Hurry," said Aniya, setting her bulb in the sonic washer bin and recycling the eating mat. I was content to munch my roll and look at the incredible view through the wall.
"Hurry, why? Are we going somewhere?"
"Meeting on the ship," said Aniya. "Our ship. Then we have to get back and see to the last provisioning of the Yggdrasil for departure tomorrow evening."
"Why on our ship?" I said. "Won't it just be crowded compared to all these other places?"
"You'll see," said Aniya.
She had slipped into soft blue zero-G trousers, pulled tight at the ankle, with a tucked-in white shirt with several stick-tight ceiling pockets. She wore gray slippers. I had gotten used to going barefoot around the cubby and in the various stems and pods.
"Hurry," she said again. "Ship's leaving in 10 minutes, and it's a long vine ride to the docking pod."
It was crowded, and although the internal containment field held the gravity to 1/6 G, it felt like a Jovian pull after sleeping in freefall. It seemed strange to be crowded in on one-dimensional plane with everyone, letting all that airspace overhead go to waste. On the library deck of the consul's ship with us, seated at the piano, on benches, in overstuffed chairs, and along hollow pit ledges, were the ousters Navson Hamnim, Sistenj Cordwell, Sion Quintana Kaan, resplendent in her feathers, the two silver vacuum-adapted ousters Palu Koror and Drivenj Nikaagat, as well as Paul Urey and Am Chapeta. Hetmastin was there, as was his superior Ket Rostin. Colonel Kassad was present, as tall as the towering ousters, and so were the Dorji Famo, looking ancient and regal in an ice-gray gown that billowed beautifully in the low gravity, as well as Lomo, Rachel, Theo, Abetic, and the Dalai Lama. None of the other sentient beings were there. Several of us stepped out on the balcony to watch the inner surface of the star tree fall behind us as the ship climbed toward the central star on its pillar of blue fusion flame. "Welcome back, Colonel Kassad," the ship said as we gathered on the library level.
I raised an eyebrow at Aniya, surprised that the ship had managed to remember his passenger from the old days.
"Thank you, ship," said the colonel.
The tall, dark man seemed distracted to the point of brooding. Climbing away from the inner shell of the biosphere star tree gave me a sense of vertigo, quite distinct from watching the sphere of a planet grow smaller and fall behind.
Here we were inside the orbital structure, and while the view from within the branches of the star tree had been one of open gaps between the leaves and trunks, glimpses of star fields on the side opposite the sun and everywhere great spaces, the view from 100,000 clicks and climbing was of a seemingly solid surface, the huge leaves reduced to a shimmering surface, looking for all the world like a great green concave ocean, and the sense of being in some huge bowl and unable to escape was almost overwhelming. The branches were growing blue from the trapped atmosphere within the containment fields there, giving thousands of clicks of vinous wood and flickering leaves a sort of blue electric glow, as if the entire inner surface were charged with voltage. And everywhere was life and motion. Ouster angels with 100-click wings not only flitted among the branches and beyond the leaves, but were hurled deeper into space, inward toward the sun, more quickly outward past the 10,000-click root systems. A myriad of smaller life forms shimmered in the blue envelope of atmosphere. Radiant gossamers, fairy chains, parrots, blue arboreals, old earth monkeys, vast schools of tropical fish swimming along in zero-g, seeking out the comet-misted regions. Blue herons, flights of geese and Martian brandyfowl, old earth porpoises. We passed out of range before I could categorize a fraction of what I was seeing. Farther out, the size of the largest life forms and swarms of life forms became apparent. From several thousand clicks up, I could see the shimmering herds of blue platelets, the sentient Acaritali, traveling together. After our first meeting here with the creatures from my cloud planet, I had asked Ania if there were any more on the biosphere star tree than the two in the conference. "A few more," my friend had said. "About 600 million more." Now I could see the Acaritali moving effortlessly on the air currents from trunk to trunk, hundreds of kilometers apart, in swarms of thousands, perhaps tens of thousands. And with them came their obedient servants, the sky squids and zeppelins and transparent medusae and vast tendrilled gas bags, similar to the one that had eaten me on the cloud world, but larger. I had estimated that original monster as perhaps 10 clicks long. These zeppelin-like work beasts must have been several hundred clicks long, perhaps longer when one factored in the countless tentacles, tendrils, flagella, whips, tails, probes, and proboscises the things sported. I realized as I watched that all of the Acaritali's giant beasts of burden were busy with tasks, weaving branches and stems and pods into elaborate bio-designs, pruning dead branches and city-sized leaves from the star tree, wrestling ouster-designed structures into place or hauling material from one part of the biosphere to another. "How many zeppelin things are the Acaritali controlling on the star tree?" I asked Ania when she was free for a second. "I don't know," she said. "Let's ask Nafsen." The ouster said, "We have no idea. They breed as needed for tasks. The Acaritali themselves are a perfect example of a swarm organism, a hive mind. None of the disk entities alone is sentient. In parallel, they are brilliant. The sky squids and other ex-Jovian world creatures have been reproducing as needed here for more than 700 standard years. I would venture that there are several hundred million working around the biosphere, perhaps a billion at this point." I stared down at the tiny forms on the dwindling biosphere surface. A billion creatures each the size of the Pinyon Plateau on my homeworld. Farther out in the gaps between the branches, a million clicks overhead and a 500,000 clicks underfoot became apparent enough. The section from which we had come was the oldest and densest, but far along the great inner curve of the biosphere there were gaps and divisions. Some planned, others yet to be filled in with living material. But even here space was busy and filled with motion. Comets arcing between roots, branches, leaves, and trunks on precise trajectories, their gift of water being volatilized from the surface by ouster-aimed and erg-powered heat beams from the trunks and from genetically adapted reflective leaves, creating mirrors hundreds of clicks across. Once turned to water vapor, the great clouds drifted across the trailing roots and misted the billion square clicks of leaf surface. larger than the comets, with a scores of carefully placed asteroids and shepherd moons moving a few thousand or tens of thousands of kilometers above the inner and outer surface of the living sphere, correcting for orbital drift, providing tides and tugs to help the branches grow correctly, throwing shadow on the biosphere's inner surface where shade was needed, and serving as observation bases and work shacks for the countless Auster and Templar gardeners who watched over the project from decade to decade and century to century. And now, a half a light minute out and accelerating toward the sun as if the ship were searching for a Hawking Drive translation point, there appeared to be even more traffic in the vast hollow of the green sphere. Auster warships, all obsolete by PAC standards, with Hawking Drive blisters or giant ram scoop containment fields, old-fashioned high-G destroyers, and C-3 ships from a long-gone era, elegant sunjammer cargo craft with great curved sails of gleaming monofilm, and everywhere the individual Auster angels, wings flapping and shimmering as they tacked in toward the sun or hurtled back out toward the biosphere. Aenea and the others stepped back inside to continue their discussion. The topic was important, still trying to find a way to stall the packs from attacking, some sort of feint or distraction that would keep the massing fleet from hurling itself this way. But I had more important things on my mind. As Abetic turned to leave the balcony, I touched the android's right sleeve. "Can you stay and talk a minute?"
"Of course, Emendymion."
The blue-skinned man's voice was as gentle as always. I waited until we were alone on the balcony, the drone of conversation from within affording us privacy outside, and leaned on the railing. "I'm sorry we haven't had more chance to talk since arriving here at the Star Tree," I said. Abetic's bald scalp gleamed in the rich sunlight. His blue-eyed gaze was calm and friendly.
"That's perfectly all right, Emendymion. Events have proven quite hectic since our arrival. I do concur, however, that this artifact does cause one to find opportunities to discuss it."
He waved his remaining hand at the huge curve of the Star Tree, to where it seemed to fade away near the central sun's brilliance.
"It's not the Star Tree or the Austers I want to talk about," I said softly, leaning a bit closer.
Abetic nodded and waited.
"You were with Aenea on all of the worlds between Old Earth and Tian Shan," I said. "Ixion, Maui Covenant, Renaissance Vector, and the others?"
"Yes, Emendymion. I had the privilege to travel with her during all the time she allowed others to travel with her."
I chewed my lip, realizing that I was about to make a fool of myself, but having no choice.
"And what about the time when she did not allow you to travel with her?" I said.
"While M. Rachel, M. Theo, and the others remained with me on Groombridge Dyson D," said Abetic. "We carried on with Emania's work, Emendymion. I was especially busy working on the construction of—"
"No, no," I interrupted. "I mean, what do you know about her absence?"
Abetic paused.
"Virtually nothing, Emendymion. She had told us that she would be away for some time. She had made provisions for our employment and continued work with her students. One day she was gone, and she was to stay away for approximately 2 standard years.
1 year, 11 months, 1 week, 6 hours, I said.
"Yes, Endymion, that is precisely correct."
"And after she returned, she never told you where she had been?"
"No, Endymion. As far as I know, she never mentioned it to any of us."
I wanted to grab Abetic's shoulders, to make him understand, to explain why this was of life and death importance to me. Would he have understood? I didn't know. Instead, attempting to sound calm, almost disinterested, and failing miserably, I said, "Did you notice anything different about Aenea when she returned from that sabbatical, Abetic?" My android friend paused, not, it seemed, out of hesitation to speak, but as if laboring to remember nuances of human emotion.
"We left for Tian Shan almost immediately after that, Emendymion. But my best recollection is that Emania was very emotional for some months, elated one minute, absolutely racked with despair the next. By the time you arrived on Tian Shan, these emotional swings had seemed to have abated.
And she never mentioned what caused them? I felt like a swine going behind my beloved's back like this, but I knew that she would not talk to me about these things.
No, Emendymion, said the android. She never talked to me about the cause. I presumed it was some event or events she experienced during her absence.
I took a deep breath. Before she left, on the other worlds, Amritsar, Potapha, any of the worlds before she left Groombridge Dyson D, had she... Was she? Had there been anyone?
I don't understand, Emendymion.
Was there a man in her life, Abedic? Someone she showed affection for? Someone who seemed especially close to her?
Ah, said the android. No, Emendymion, there seemed to be no male who showed any special interest in Emenea, other than as a teacher and possible messiah, of course.
Yeah, I said. And no one came back with her after the 1 year, 11 months, 1 week, and 6 hours?
No, Emendymion.
I gripped Abedic's shoulder. Thank you, my friend. I'm sorry I'm asking these stupid questions. It's just that... I don't understand. Somewhere there's a... Shit, it doesn't matter. It's just stupid human emotion. I turned to go in to join the others. Abedic stopped me with a hand on my wrist.
Emendymion, he said softly, if love is the human emotion to which you refer, I feel that I have watched humankind long enough during my existence to know that love is never a stupid emotion. I feel that Emenea is correct when she teaches that it may well be the mainspring energy of the universe.
I stood and watched, gaping, as the android left the balcony and went into the crowded library level. They were close to making a decision.
I think we should send the Gideon Drive courier drone with a message, Ania was saying as I came into the lounge. Send it direct and within the hour.
They'll confiscate the drone, said Sion Quintana Ka'an in her musical contralto. And it's the only ship we have left with the instantaneous drive.
Good, said Ania. They're an abomination. Every time they are used, part of the void is destroyed.
Still, said Paul Urey, his thick ouster dialect sounding like someone speaking through radio static. There remains the option of using the drone as a delivery system.
To launch nuclear warheads or plasma weapons against the Armada? Said Ania. I thought that we had dismissed that possibility.
It's our only way of striking at them before they strike at us, said Colonel Kassad.
It would do no good,
said the Templar, true voice of the Star Tree, Kent Rostine.
The drones are not built for precise targeting. An Archangel-class warship would destroy it light minutes away from target. I agree with the one who teaches. Send the message.
But will the message stop their attack? Said Sistenge Cordwell.
Ania made the little gesture that I knew so well.
There are no guarantees, but if it puts them off balance, at least they will use their instantaneous drive drones to postpone the attack. It is worth a try, I think.
And what will the message say? Said Rachel.
Please hand me that vellum and stylus, said Ania.
Theo brought the items and set them on the Steinway. Everyone, including me, crowded close as Ania wrote.
To Pope Urban XVI and Cardinal Lourdesami, I am coming to Pacem, to the Vatican. Ania.
There, said my young friend, handing the vellum to Navson Hamnim.
Please set this in the courier drone when we dock. Set the transponder to carrying hard copy message and launch it to Pacem system.
The ouster took the vellum. I had not yet developed the knack of reading the ouster's facial expressions, but I could tell that something was giving him pause. Perhaps it was a lesser form of the same sort of panic and confusion that was filling my chest at the moment.
I am coming to Pacem.
What the goddamn hell did that mean? How could Ania go to Pacem and survive? She could not. And wherever she was going, I was certain of only one thing, that I would be at her side. Which meant that she was going to kill me as well,
if she was as good as her word, which she always had been.
I am coming to Pacham. Was it just a ploy to deter their fleet, an empty threat, a way of stalling them? I wanted to shake my beloved until her teeth fell out, or until she explained everything to me.
"Rawl," she said, gesturing me closer. I thought that perhaps this was the explanation I wanted, that she was reading my expression from across the room and saw the turmoil within me. But all she said was, "Palu Koror and Drivenj Nekaagat are going to show me what it means to fly like an angel. Do you want to come with me? Lomo's coming."
Fly like an angel?
For a moment I was sure that she was speaking gibberish.
"They have an extra skin suit if you want to come," Ania was saying. "But we have to go now. We're almost back to the Star Tree, and the ship will be docking in a few minutes. Het Mastin has to get on with the loading and provisioning of the Yggdrasil, and I have 100 things to do before tomorrow."
"Yeah," I said, not knowing what I was agreeing to. "I'll come along." At the time, I was feeling surly enough to think that this response was a wonderful metaphor for my entire 10-year odyssey. "Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing or getting into, but count me in." One of the space-adapted ousters, Palu Koror, handed us the skin suits. I had used skin suits before, of course, the last time being just a few weeks earlier, when Ania and I had climbed Tai Shan, the great peak of the Middle Kingdom, although it seemed like months or years ago. But I had never seen or felt a skin suit like these. Skin suits go back many centuries, the working concept being that the best way to keep from exploding in vacuum is not a bulky pressure suit as in the earliest days of spaceflight, but a covering so thin that it allows perspiration to pass even while it protects the skin from the terrible heat, cold, and vacuum of space. Skin suits had not changed much in all those centuries, except to incorporate rebreathing filaments and osmosis panels. Of course, my last skin suit had been a hegemony artifact, workable enough until Radamanth Nemes had clawed it to shreds. But this was no ordinary skin suit. Silver, malleable as mercury, the thing felt like a warm but weightless blob of protoplasm when Palu Koror dropped it in my hand. It shifted like mercury. No, it shifted and flowed like a living, fluid thing. I almost dropped it in my shock, catching it with my other hand, only to watch it flow several centimeters up my wrist and arm like some flesh-eating alien. I must have said something out loud, because Ania said, "It is alive, Rawl. The skin suit's an organism. Gene-tailored and nanotech, but only 3 molecules thick."
"How do I put it on?"
I said, watching it flow up my arm to the sleeve of my tunic, then retreat. I had the impression that the thing was more carnivore than garment. And the problem with any skin suit was that they had to be worn next to the skin. One did not wear layers under a skin suit, anywhere.
"Uh-huh," said Ania.
"It's easy. None of the pulling and tugging we had to do with the old skin suits. Just strip naked, stand very still, and drop the thing on your head. It'll flow down over you, and we have to hurry."
This inspired something less than great enthusiasm in me. Ania and I excused ourselves and jogged up the spiral stairs to the bedroom level at the apex of the ship. Once there, we hurried out of our clothes. I looked at my beloved, standing naked next to the console's ancient, and quite comfortable, as I remembered, bed, and was about to suggest a better use of our time before the tree ship docked. But Ania just waggled a finger at me, held the blob of silver protoplasm above her, and dropped it in her hair. It was alarming watching the silver organism engulf her, flowing down over her brown blonde hair like liquid metal, covering her eyes and mouth and chin, flowing down her neck like reflective lava, then covering her shoulders, breasts, belly, hip bones, pubis, thighs, knees. Finally, she lifted first one foot and then the other, and the engulfment was complete.
"Are you all right?" I said. My voice small, my own blob of silver still pulsing in my hand, eager to get at me. Ania, or the chrome statue that had been Ania, gave me a thumbs up and gestured to her throat. I understood. As with the hegemony skin suits, communication from now on would be via sub-vocalization pickups. I lifted the pulsing mass in both hands, held my breath, closed my eyes, and dropped it on my head.
It took less than 5 seconds. For a terrible instant, I was sure that I could not breathe, feeling the slick mass over my nose and mouth. But then I remembered to inhale, and the oxygen came cool and fresh. "Can you hear me, Rawl?" Her voice was much more distinct than the hair patch pickups on the old suit. I nodded, then sub-vocalized.
"Yeah, weird feeling."
"Are you ready, Emania? Emendymion?"
It took me a second to realize that it was the other adapted ouster, Drivenj Nikaagat, on the suit line. I had heard his voice before, but translated via speech synthesizer. On the direct line, his voice was even more clear and melodious than the birdsong of Sion Quintana Ka'an.
"Ready," responded Ania.
And we went down the spiral stairs, through the throng, and out onto the balcony.
"Good luck, Emania, Emendymion."
It was A. Bedick speaking to us through one of the ship's comlinks. The android touched each of us on our respective silver shoulders as we stepped next to Koror and Nikaagat at the balcony railing. Lomo was also waiting, his silver skin suit showing every ridge of delineated muscle on his arms, thighs, and flat belly. I felt awkward for a moment, wishing either that I was wearing something over this micron-thin layer of silver fluid, or that I worked harder at keeping in shape. Ania looked beautiful, the body that I loved sculpted in chrome. I was glad that no one but the android had followed the five of us onto the balcony. The ship was within a couple thousand clicks of the star tree and decelerating hard. Palu Koror made a motion and jumped easily onto the thin balcony rail, balancing against the 1/6 G. Drivenj Nikaagat followed suit, and then Lomo, then Ania, and finally, much less gracefully, I joined them. The sense of height and exposure was all but overwhelming. The great green basin of the star tree beneath us, the leafy walls rising into the unblinking distance on all sides, the bulk of the ship curving away beneath us, balancing on the slim column of fusion fire, like a building teetering on a fragile blue column. I realized with a sickening feeling that we were going to jump.
"Do not worry. I will open the containment field at the precise instant you pass through and go to EM repulsors until you are clear of the drive exhaust."
I realized that it was the ship speaking. I had no idea of what we were doing.
"The suit should give you a rough idea of our adaptation," Palu Koror was saying. "Of course, for those of us who have chosen full integration, it is not the semi-sentient suits and their molecular microprocessors that allow us to live and travel in space, but the adapted circuits in our skin, our blood, our vision, and brains."
"How do we—" I began, having some trouble sub-vocalizing, as if the dryness in my mouth would have any effect on my throat muscles.
"Do not worry," said Nikaagat.
"We will not deploy our wings until proper separation is achieved. They will not collide. The fields would not allow it. Controls are quite intuitive. Your suit's optical systems should interface with your nervous system and neurosensors, calling up data when required."
"Data? What data?" I had only meant to think that, but the suit comm sent it out. Ania took my silver hand in hers.
"This will be fun, Rawl. The only free minutes we're going to have today, I think. Or for a while."
At that moment, poised on the railing on the edge of a terrifying vertical drop through fusion flame and vacuum, I did not really focus on the meaning of her words.
"Come," said Palu Koror, and leaped from the railing.
Still holding hands, Ania and I jumped together. She let go of my hand and we spun away from one another. The containment field parted and ejected us a safe distance. The fusion drive paused as the five of us spun away from the ship, then it relit, the ship seeming to hurtle upward and away from us as its deceleration outpaced our own. And we continued dropping. That sensation was overwhelming, five silver spread-eagled forms separating farther and farther from each other, all plummeting toward the star tree lattice still several thousand clicks beneath. Then our wings opened.
"For our purposes today, the light wings need only be a kilometer or so across," came Palu Koror's voice in my ears. Were we traveling farther or faster, they would extend much farther, perhaps several hundred kilometers.
When I raised my arms, the panels of energy extruding from my skin suit unfurled like butterfly wings. I felt the sudden push of sunlight.
What we feel is more the current of the primary magnetic field line we are following, said Palu Koror. If I may slave your suits for a second. There.
Vision shifted. I looked to my left, to where Aenea fell, already several clicks away. A shining silver chrysalis set within expanding gold wings. The others glowed beyond her. I could see the solar wind, see the charged particles and currents of plasma flowing and spiraling outward along the infinitely complex geometry of the heliosphere. Red lines of twisting magnetic field coiling as if painted on the inner surfaces of an ever-shifting chambered nautilus. All this convoluted, multi-layered, multicolored writhing of plasma streams flowing back to a sun that no longer seemed a pale star, but was the locus of millions of converging field lines, entire sheets of plasma being evicted at 400 kilometers a second and being drawn into these shapes by the pulsing magnetic fields in its north and south equators. I could see the violet streamers of the inward-rushing magnetic lines, weaving and interlacing with the crimson-red of the outward-exploding sheets of field current. I could see the blue vortices of heliospheric shockwave around the outer edges of the star tree, the moons and comets cutting through plasma medium like ocean-going ships at night plowing through a glowing, phosphorescent sea. And could see our gold wings interacting with this plasma and magnetic medium, catching photons like billions of fireflies in our nets, sail surfaces surging to the plasma currents, our silver bodies accelerating out along the great shimmering folds and spiral magnetic geometries of the heliosphere matrix. In addition to this enhanced vision, the suit opticals were overlaying trajectory information and computational data that meant nothing to me, but must have meant life or death to these space-adapted ousters. The equations and functions flashed by, seemingly floating in the distance at critical focus, and I remember only a sampling. Even without understanding any of these equations, I knew that we were approaching the star tree too fast. In addition to the ship's velocity, we had picked up our own speed from the solar wind and the plasma stream. I began to see how these ouster energy wings could move one out from a star, and at an impressive velocity. But how did one stop within what looked to be less than 1,000 kilometers?
"This is fantastic," came Lomo's voice. "Amazing!"
I rotated my head far enough to see our flyer friend from Tian Shan far to our left and many kilometers below us. He had already entered the leaf zone and was swooping and soaring just above the blue blur of the containment field that surrounded the branches and spaces between the branches like an osmotic membrane. How the hell did he do that, I wondered. Again, I must have sub-vocalized the thought, for I heard Lomo's deep, distinctive laugh, and he sent,
"Use the wings, Rawl, and cooperate with the tree and the ergs."
Cooperate with the tree and the ergs? My friend must have lost his reason. Then I saw Aenea extending her wings, manipulating them by both thought and the movement of her arms. I looked beyond her to the world of branches approaching us at horrifying velocity, and then I began to see the trick.
"That's good," came Drivenge Nika'agat's voice. "Catch the repelling wind, good!"
I watched the two adapted ousters flutter like butterflies, saw the torrent of plasma energy rising from the star tree to surround them, and suddenly hurtled past them as if they had opened parachutes and I was still in freefall. Panting against the skin suit field, my heart pounding, I spread my arms and legs and willed the wings wider. The energy folds shimmered and expanded to at least 2 clicks. Beneath me, an expanse of leaves shifted, turned slowly and purposefully, as if in a time-lapse nature hollow of flowers seeking the light, folded over one another to form a smooth parabolic dish at least 5 clicks across, and then went perfectly reflective. Sunlight blazed against me.
If I had been watching with unshielded eyes, I would have been instantly blinded. As it was, the suit optics polarized. I heard the sunlight striking my skin suit and wings like hard rain on a metal roof. I opened my wings wider to catch the blazing gust of light at the same instant the ergs on the star tree below folded the heliosphere matrix, bending the plasma stream back against Aenea and me, decelerating both of us rapidly but not painfully so. Wings flapping, we passed into the bowering outbranches of the star tree, while the suit optics continued to flow data across my field of vision, which somehow assured me that the tree was providing the proper amount of the sun's light based on its mass and luminosity, while the erg was providing just enough heliospheric plasma and magnetic feedback to bring us to near zero delta V before we struck one of the huge main branches or interdicted the containment field. Aenea and I followed the ousters, using our wings in the same way they used theirs, soaring and then flapping, breaking and then expanding to catch the true sun's light to accelerate again, swooping in among the outer branches, soaring over the leafy outer layer of the star tree, then diving deep among the branches again, folding our wings to pass between pods or covered bridges out beyond the core containment fields, swooping around busily working space squids whose tentacles were 10 times longer than the consul's ship, now decelerating carefully through the leaf level, then opening our wings again to surge past floating schools of thousands of blue pulsing Acaratelae platelets, which seemed to be waving at us as we passed. There was a huge platform branch just below the containment field shimmer. I did not know if the wings would work through the field, but Palu Koror passed through with only a shimmer, like a graceful diver cutting through still water, followed by Drivenge Nekaagat, then by Lomo, then Aenea, and finally I joined them, folding my wings to a dozen or so meters across as I crossed the energy barrier into air and sound and scent and cool breezes once again. We landed on the platform.
"Very nice for a first flight," said Palu Koror, her voice synthesized for the atmosphere. "We wanted to share just a moment of our lives with you."
Aenea deactivated the skin suit around her face, allowing it to flow into a collar of fluid mercury. Her eyes were bright, as alive as I had ever seen them. Her fair skin was flushed and her hair was damp with sweat.
"Wonderful," she cried and turned to squeeze my hand. "Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you, Freeman Nekaagat. Freewoman Koror."
"It was our pleasure, revered one who teaches," said Nekaagat with a bow.
I looked up and realized that the Yggdrasil was docked with the star tree just above us, the tree ship's kilometer of branches and trunk mingling perfectly with the biosphere branches. Only the fact that the consul's ship had slowly docked and was being pulled into a storage pod by a worker squid allowed me to see the tree ship. Crew clones were visible, working feverishly, carrying provisions and Mobius cubes into Hetmastine's tree ship, and I could see scores of plant stem life support umbilicals and connector stems running from the star tree to the tree ship. Aenea had not released my hand. When I turned my gaze from the tree ship hanging above us to my friend, she leaned closer and kissed me on the lips.
"Can you imagine, Rol? Millions of the space-adapted ousters living out there, seeing all that energy all the time, flying for weeks and months in the empty spaces, running the bow shock rapids of magnetospheres and vortices around planets, riding the solar wind plasma shockwaves out 10 AUs or more, and then flying farther, to the heliopause termination shock boundary 75 to 150 AUs from the star, out to where the solar wind ends and the interstellar medium begins, hearing the hiss and whispers and surf crash of the universe's ocean. Can you imagine?"
"No," I said. I could not. I did not know what she was talking about. Not then. Abetic, Rachel, Theo, Kassad, and the others descended from a transit vine. Rachel carried clothes for Aenea. Abetic brought my clothes. Ousters and others surrounded my friend again, demanding answers to urgent questions, seeking clarifications of orders, reporting on the imminent launch of the Gideon Drive drone.
we were swept apart by the press of other people. Ania looked back and waved. I raised my hand, still silver from the skin suit, to wave back. But she was gone. That evening, several hundred of us took a transport pod pulled by a squid to a site many thousands of clicks to the northwest, above the plane of the ecliptic, along the inner shell of the biosphere star tree. But the voyage lasted less than 30 minutes because the squid took a shortcut, cutting an arc through space from our section of the sphere to the new one. The architecture of living pods and communal platforms, branch towers and connecting bridges on this section of the tree, while still so close to our region by any meaningful geography of this huge structure, looked different, larger, more baroque, alien. And the Austers and Templars here spoke a slightly different dialect, while the space-adapted Austers ornamented themselves with bands of shimmering color that I had not seen before. There were different birds and beasts in the atmosphere zones here, exotic fish swimming through misted air, great herds of something that looked like old Earth killer whales with short arms and elegant hands. And this was only a few thousand clicks from the region I knew. I could not imagine the diversity of cultures and life forms throughout this biosphere. For the first time I realized what Ania and the others had been telling me over and over. There was more internal surface on the sections of the completed biosphere than the total of all the planetary surfaces discovered by humankind in the past 1,000 years of interstellar flight. When the star tree was completed, the internal biosphere quickened. The volume of habitable space would exceed all the inhabitable worlds in the Milky Way galaxy. We were met by officials, feted for a few moments on crowded 1/6G platforms among hundreds of Auster and Templar dignitaries, then taken into a pod so large that it might have been a small moon. A crowd of several 100,000 Austers and Templars waited, with a few hundred Sinestri Alouette and hovering crowds of Akaratelai near the central dais. Blinking, I realized that the Ergs had set the internal containment field at a comfortable 1/6G, pulling everyone toward the surface of the sphere. But then I noticed that the seats continued up and over and around the full interior of the sphere. I revised my estimate of the crowd to well over 1 million. Auster Freeman Navsun Hamnim and Templar True Voice of the Star Tree Ket Rostine introduced Ania, saying that she brought with her the message that their people had awaited for centuries. My young friend walked to the podium, looking up and around and down, as if making eye contact with every person in the huge space. The sound system was so sophisticated that we could have heard her swallow or breathe. My beloved looked calm. "Choose again," said Ania. And she turned, walked away from the podium, and went down to where the chalices lay on the long table. Hundreds of us donated our blood, mere drops, as the chalices of wine were passed out to the waiting multitudes. I knew that there was no way that 1 million waiting Auster and Templar communicants could be served by a few hundred of us who had already received communion from Ania. But the aides drew a few drops with sterile lancets. The drops were transferred to the reservoir of wine. Scores of helpers passed chalice bulbs under the spigots, and within the hour those who wished communion with Ania's wine blood had received it. The great sphere began emptying. After her two words, nothing else had been said through the entire evening. For the first time on that long, endless day, there was silence in the transport pod traveling home. Home. Back to our region of the Star Tree under the shadow of the Yggdrasil, destined to depart within 20 hours. I had felt like a fraud. I had drunk the wine almost 24 hours earlier, but I had felt nothing this day. Nothing, except my usual love for Ania, which is to say my absolutely unusual, unique, totally without referent or equal love for Ania. The multitudes who wanted to drink had drunk. The great sphere had emptied, with even those who had not come to the communion silent, whether with disappointment at my beloved's two-word speech,
or pondering something beyond and beneath that I did not know. We took the transport pod back to our region of the Star Tree, and we were silent except for the most necessary of communications. It was not an awkward or disappointed silence, more a silence of awe bordering on fear at the terminus of one part of one's life and the beginning, the hope for a beginning, of another. Choose again. Ania and I made love in the darkened living pod, despite our fatigue and the late hour. Our lovemaking was slow and tender and almost unbearably sweet. Choose again. They were the last words in my mind as I finally drifted, literally, off to sleep. Choose again. I understood. I chose Ania and life with Ania. And I believe that she had chosen me. And I would choose her, and she would choose me again tomorrow. And the tomorrow after that. And in every hour during those tomorrows. Choose again. Yes. Yes.